It's the 21st of October 2011, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a radio programme and podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. What you talking about, Willits? Why is the science minister giving lab technicians a pat on the back? Why did it take so long to translate Solaris, and why didn't it melt in the process? Maybe I'm thinking of a Solero, actually. But how are transgendered people treated by the media? And is the fact that we're covering it already suggesting the answer is not very well? And is today the end of the world? Again. But first, is winning a Nobel Prize good for wine sales? We start this week with the Nobel Prize, and remarkably, we've somehow got an interview with one of this year's winners. Alas, we haven't been able to get hold of the guy who died just hours before it was announced that he won. We did try calling psychic Sally to see if she could help, but when we called her, she was driving and wasn't wearing her earpiece, so wasn't able to pick up. Instead, Kash Farouk has been speaking to Brian Schmidt, who is one of the pioneers of dark matter, and was announced as one of the winners of this year's Nobel Prize in Physics. Here's Kash with more.
Brian Schmidt of the Australian National University in Canberra was recently named as the joint winner of the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics. The formal citation reads, "For the discovery of the accelerating expansion of the universe through observations of distant supernovae." Brian and his team's work on the expansion of the universe fundamentally changed astrophysics. It opened up a whole new area of science and introduced the world to the concept of dark energy. Brian kindly agreed for me to call him to chat about the award and the science behind it. Thank you for speaking to the Pod Delusion Nobel laureate, Brian Schmidt.
My pleasure.
Firstly, let me congratulate on your award. It's well-deserved.
Well, I hope so. Sometimes I have my doubts, but it has certainly been a great experience.
Yeah, I bet it has. Have things calmed down yet, apart from random people like me asking if I can interview you? Has anything else changed?
Well, it's still pretty busy, although it has calmed down. The first day was just completely insane, and now the requests are becoming longer and more complicated.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. You moved to the U.S. From the U.S. to Australia in '94, and made the discovery in '98. Can you explain what your team were doing? You know, what projects you were setting up, what you discovered, how you went about discovering, you know, this acceleration.
Yeah, so I finished my PhD at Harvard in 1993, and I started a postdoctoral fellowship at the what they call the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. I was actually sort of a part of the Smithsonian side rather than the Harvard side, and I was looking for something to do. And in 1994, Mario Hamui from Chile came up and showed us his new data on supernovae, which showed that you could use them to measure distances very precisely. And at the same time, Saul Perlmutter, who had been trying to discover supernovae for about 6 years in 1994, suddenly found seven of them all at once. And so I was going down to observe in Chile in 1994, and so I had a chat with the group down there, and a man named Nick Sunseft, who is an astronomer down there, and I hatched the plan that we would take on Saul Perlmutter's team in measuring how fast the universe was slowing down over time. And this was just before I moved to Australia. I knew I was moving to Australia. And so I figured that although Saul's team had been working on this a long time, our team had been working on it from the other side, that is the supernova side. And so it seemed to me to be a reasonable thing to go out and try this experiment. And in the end, when I moved to Australia, it was really about trying to measure what the universe did back in time by looking at really, really distant objects that I really put my heart and soul in when I got here to Australia for really 3.5 years.
One of the interesting stories that neatly demonstrates how science can work is, you know, you were out there to show that it was slowing down, and you found the exact opposite, which opened up the whole new area of physics. Can you tell me more about that?
Yes. Yeah, so I always like to work on big questions. And so when I came to Australia, I figured, you know, I might as well try to answer a big question. The question I was looking to answer was how fast does the universe slow down and therefore gauge the future of the universe? If the universe slows down a little bit, then it'll just keep expanding forever. If the universe slows down a lot, then the universe will reach a maximum size, and then gravity will take over and run the universe in reverse, And just like a ball that you throw up in the air, it will crash down and we'd get the Big Bang in reverse, which we like to call the Gnab-Gib. So that was the big question we were trying to answer. So after 3.5 years, well, 3 years, I guess, the data were coming in, and I was talking to Adam Reese, who was, you know, spearheading this work. We sort of handed out each part of the project to young people. And so Adam was, you know, one of the few young people on the team. So he's doing a huge amount of work. And he was showing the data, and that data showed, geez, the universe wasn't slowing down at all. It was speeding up. And so that was a real crazy thing to be confronted with. It didn't make a lot of sense. It seemed just impossible. So it was a pretty scary time when we first saw that result.
How many times did you have to, you know, double check, triple check your results before you actually had the guts to make the announcement?
Well, we went through and, you know, initially you just start looking for problems and checking and rechecking everything. But after a while, you've sort of done everything you can and nothing's obviously wrong. So, you know, we sort of opened it up to the team and said, okay, guys, we got this crazy result. Any test you want us to do, we'll test. We think we've tested them all at this point, but anything you want to do. And they have, you know, they the group came up with all sorts of things to think about. So we went through and worked more. But at some point, it slowly sunk in that the universal acceleration we were seeing just wasn't going to go away. So, you know, it took a few months, but we did everything we can several times, had several people do it, and everyone just got the same answer.
So when you made the announcement, just like the recent faster-than-light neutrinos announcement, what was the reaction around the world? Were scientists skeptical?
Well, I was expecting a reaction very similar to the faster-than-light neutrino announcement, where I think, you know, they've gone out. It's a good team. They've gone out and said, hey, we see this, and most of the world says it's got to be wrong. In our case, I was expecting people to say, this is just wrong and we'll figure out the problem. But some people were skeptical, and I don't blame them for being skeptical. I would have been skeptical as well. I was skeptical when we released it. I couldn't make the result go away. So the problem was, there were some problems in cosmology back in 1998 where things didn't quite work properly. The accelerating universe, if you used it to, you know, if you thought what made the universe accelerate, the only easy way to do it was to have the universe full of energy that had been previously unaccounted for, the stuff we call dark energy now, or what Einstein called the cosmological constant. Now, it turns out that this dark energy fixed most of the outstanding problems in cosmology. Now, it wasn't that this dark energy had been disproved particularly. It was just crazy that somehow we had missed 75% of the universe, and this 75% of the universe caused gravity to work in reverse. So it wasn't that, you know, that it had been disproved before, but it just seemed too crazy to believe. Yeah, so I think in case of the guys who are measuring the faster than speed of light neutrinos, you know, I commend them from coming out. I have to admit, I suspect there will be something found wrong, but I could be wrong. You know, maybe the universe really is crazy. And for some reason, these neutrinos, which are at very high energy, just travel faster than the other neutrinos we've been able to measure from supernovae, for example.
Well, and what does the award mean for Australian science? How has the media and the public reacted?
So, you know, it's been really positive here. I think Australia hasn't had a Nobel Prize winner in physics since 1950. The Braggs, so Bragg scattering, very important discovery. So it's been a long time between drinks. Australia spends a lot of effort on science, and we have a very good university system here. But I think the excitement of a Nobel Prize really has captured everyone. So I've got to meet with, you know, members of both parties, the prime minister, the finance minister. Everyone is just really excited. Even the what I would describe as the shock jocks on radio have been universally really excited about it. So it's really been incredibly positive. And I think it's caused the country, as best as I can tell, to reflect a bit on why science is important. And of course, that's what's really important to me. I want people to understand that the country's future prosperity really depends on educating people and getting a bunch of scientists to go up and be able to do things, invent new technology, and that's what the prosperity is going to be. So from my perspective, it's been universally positive.
I'm going to have to ask you the question that I'm sure everyone has asked you. Did you think somebody was winding you up when you received the phone call?
I was suspicious that I have a couple of mischievous graduate students, and it occurred to me that just possibly it was a practical joke, but I was incredibly impressed with how good they got the Swedish accent. But after a couple seconds, it became pretty clear to me this was more than just a prank.
Okay, final question. Astrophysics is not your only passion. You're also a winemaker. And judging by the We Have Sold Out message on your website, winning a Nobel Prize is good for wine sales.
Yeah, so I decided when I moved out to the farm that I live at now that one of the things I could do in Australia that I couldn't do anywhere else was do something crazy like run a vineyard. And so on our farm, we have a 1.1 hectare Pinot Noir vineyard, which I work at, and it's my therapy, so make sure astronomy doesn't take over my life. And so things were slow at first. I've been, crafting, working on my trade of making wine. But yeah, about a year ago, I started getting it pretty right and have been selling out. And so I was down to 4 cases of wine when the Nobel Prize announcement went. And those 4 cases of wine went in literally 60 seconds after the announcement. So we'll see. It's certainly a great marketing tool, which I've been recommending to all my fellow winemakers here in Canada.
Okay, I think that's a good place to end. Brian, thank you very, very much indeed, and congratulations again.
My pleasure.
This has been Cash Farouk talking to the newly minted Nobel laureate, Brian Schmidt, for the Poddelusion.
Now, all this week and next week is the London Science Festival, and one of the highlights of this year's programme was the Science Council's third annual Roberts Lecture at the Royal Medical Society, which was given by the Science and Universities Minister, David Willetts. You can hear the lecture in full on the Poddelusion extra feed on our website at poddelusion.co.uk, but we also managed to snag a couple of minutes with the man himself afterwards to talk about some of the key points. If you're a long-term listener of the Poddelusion, you may remember that we've actually spoken to him on the show before, which, yes, puts us in the unusual position of perhaps being able to get away with referring to a Tory cabinet minister as a friend of the show. And as Dave, as I like to call him, is now my friend, I didn't dare ask him about any of the dodgy stuff he's been involved in. And yes, by dodgy stuff, I essentially mean everything that the Coalition has done to universities. But nevertheless, here's me talking to the Science and Universities Minister David Willetts. So we're here with the Universities and Science Minister, David Willetts, who's just given the fascinating lecture today, David. What would be the one takeaway point you think people should take away from the lecture? Because you covered a broad range of topics.
Well, we've published today evidence that shows that we have one of the most productive and effective science and research bases in the world, and we can be very proud of that. And secondly, that I do really understand the need to make sure we've got the structure of science careers right, and that we've got to make the best of our postgrads researching in science, and of course what they go on to do, even if it's outside academic scientific activity, can still be really valuable and worthwhile for them and for the wider country.
One of the interesting things was you painted a very rosy picture of the UK's research base, which I thought contrasted interestingly with the Science is Vital report, which painted a less positive picture. How do you square the two?
Well, no, actually I don't think there is a tension there. I mean, we have protected the science budget, £4.6 billion a year for each of the next 4 years. And, of course, we've got all these really big science capital projects, 6 of them already that have got the highest priority that are now going ahead. But alongside all that funding, we have to make sure that there are proper opportunities inside academic science and outside for young researchers. That's what Science is Vital has raised with me. They're right to raise it with me. Next week, I'm going to the Royal Society to join Paul Nurse there to discuss this whole issue in a roundtable.
Brilliant. The other big thing announced today was a new register for technicians and so on. What's the significance of that?
Well, you see, I think this is an example of the links between science and technology. And if you go to the Cavendish Labs at Cambridge, they still preserve the cloud chambers that were the product of incredibly skilled glassblowers that enabled them to win Nobel Prizes for physics a century ago. And technology matters. And I think sometimes in the science community, we underestimate the value of the technicians that provide the kit, that repair the kit, that update and create new kit. And what I've announced today is that we're going to be supporting the Technicians Council to create a technician standard, a recognition that being a technician is a worthwhile thing. It's the kind of thing they do in Germany. For decades, we failed to do it in Britain. We're going to start doing it now.
Brilliant. And we'll put links to find out about all that on the Poddelusion website. David Willis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
After the lecture, we also spoke to a bunch of other people there to gauge some reactions from the floor, as it was full of eminent science types. Here's Liz Luckendorf.
From the interviews James conducted, the reaction to David Willetts' lecture was broadly positive. Most thought that Willetts is generally a competent and interested science minister, who seems more hampered by the limits of his party rather than any antagonism towards the science community. Looking at some of the positive elements of the talk, James talked with John Ellison, the head of education strategy at the Eden Project.
What did you make of what Willetts had to say?
I thought it was very interesting. I was particularly interested in what he had to say about the importance of technical skills, about the importance of commercialisation, about the importance of connecting up the different sciences, about the importance of excellence as opposed to which journal you're published in. I thought that was quite an interesting part. I should be interested to see how the novel structures for the research excellence framework with HEFCE work to people's advantage and to find excellence wherever it was, as opposed to just concentrated in a few elitist centres. So that's quite interesting, you know, and to connect that to innovation and to connect it, although what he said was that it's a very complex connection between research and innovation and actually produce and an impact on the economy. I'd like to see an awful lot more emphasis on that side of things. So you can do blue skies research. It's really, really necessary and interesting. But to be able to think into the applied nature of what you do and how that can transform things is also, I think, critically important. And I was really pleased to hear that recognised.
You work in education in your role, and it mentioned, and the big announcement today is a new technician register.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you think this is going to have a big impact?
I think it's going to have a very important impact, because technicians for years have been undervalued in terms of obviously their wages and their salary, but also in terms of esteem. And actually, we have to get away from this kind of dichotomous hierarchy between the intellectual and the practical. They need to be combined. So, for example, things like university technical colleges at the moment, which combine knowledge and skills and practical application. Absolutely critical if we're going to have a healthy economy.
Well, Imran Khan from Campaign for Science and Engineering also agrees that Willetts is a very clued-in science minister. In this short clip, he highlights some of the issues with the science policy and pitfalls that might await the science infrastructure in the UK.
There was a report that came out this morning that Biz actually put out. It was done by Elsevier, the publishers, and it basically said everything in the UK research base is really rosy. You know, we've got one of the most efficient research bases in the world. Our scientists are producing all these papers. You know, we only spend 3% of the world's GDP on R&D, but actually we punch above our weight in everything we're doing. You'll have heard that I asked a question at the end, which is like, well, that's all fantastic. However, this is all based on everything that happened before all this, the spending review stuff last year. So in October last year, you know, this is, you know, the Science is Vital campaign reached the climax, we had the spending review, and people were saying science was saved. And in actual fact, that's what it appeared like at the time, because we were expecting and braced for 30% cuts. And what we got seemed like a cash freeze. But the more you look at it, the more it seems to unravel. So although we got a cash freeze, we're now seeing we've got record inflation. It's reached 5.2%, which means that's the level at which that settlement's degrading. And also it didn't include capital. And I think the trouble I have is that most politicians seem to think that you can just separate resource from capital. So resource is what you pay people day to day to actually, you know, their salaries, and capital is what you use for building fantastic new labs and, you know, buying a new particle accelerator. But actually what it means is often, you know, you need capital to buy new microscopes, you need to buy, you know, this, that and the other to keep labs going. And over the next few years, you're going to find those things break, they become obsolete, and if we can't replace them, which we're not going to be able to because we had a 50% cut in capital funding, it's really going to start to bite. And that's the question I raised, and I said, look, we've really got to start coming to terms with the fact that although you said science was saved, you've done that by redefining what science budget was.
So is there any indication of what's under threat then if the money's all disappearing?
After I asked my question, the minister accused me of being very pessimistic, and I really am not, because I don't think, you know, anything's going to drop off the precipice immediately. Mm. Nothing's going to, well, I hope nothing's going to shut down in the next few years. But what you're going to see instead is a gradual accumulation of things which just aren't working as well as they should be. And when we're trying to compete with nations like China, like Japan, like Germany, like the US, which are still investing money in new capital and new research, if you're, you know, one of the world's top scientists, you're looking to base your new lab somewhere, where are you going to pick? Are you going to pick somewhere that's, you know, just a bit rough around the edges, or are you going to pick somewhere that's, you know, the gleaming hub and the completely at the forefront of research? So that's what we're concerned by.
One of the issues raised by David Willetts was that scientists should think more on how their ideas could have business or development applications. He stressed that this would not be a part of the assessment of funding and that blue sky research is important in its own right. Robert Massey, who is the Deputy Executive Secretary for Media Policy, Education and Outreach at the Royal Astronomical Society, talks a little about the nuance in this area in regards to astronomy and geophysics.
I think there's a real question of interpretation here. If impact is about, look, you know, you have some great ideas in your field, you've got spin-off technologies, and that gets translated to the wider world, that's absolutely fine. If it becomes the driving factor for the research, clearly that isn't going to work with Blue Skies research, which by its very nature is about curiosity. It's about doing things which you have no idea whether they will have an application or not. Now, in astronomy, we have really good examples, like, for example, GPS, so sat-navs, you know, depend on understanding general relativity and also depend on understanding the way satellites behave in orbit, very much connected with astronomy. We have things like Wi-Fi. I mean, most of the people in the room tonight, or a lot of people in the room tonight anyway, were tweeting, and they were doing that because of the, you know, the fantastic mobile network we've got because of wireless technology that was developed by a radio astronomer.
And that's not a hard sell to government who have to think.
I think what you can say is that obviously, look, if you fund astronomy, you're not going to predict very easily which technologies come out of this. But on the other hand, if you didn't fund it, then you can be sure that a lot of those things wouldn't have done. And it's actually also about bringing people into science and research per se. You know, they come into the field, they get a fantastic intellectual training, and actually the vast majority go out into other occupations. Now, that might be in the civil service. They might be the people advising David Willetts, or they might be going off into wider industry. But nonetheless, the superb training they get, the analytical skills they get, the ability to solve problems, is what stands them in good stead.
Finally, we had an intriguing few minutes with Holly Chandler and Kate Harmer, who work for the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology in the Houses of Parliament. They help interpret and report on research for MPs and committees to reach decisions on. We thought their job was quite interesting in how science is communicated inside Parliament, and so asked them a few questions as well, as they weren't, because of their work in Parliament, able to comment on Willetts' lecture itself.
So the office provides briefings and short, we call them post notes, which are 4-page reports for MPs to use as a source in certain areas of science and technology which are topical within Parliament.
So is it a challenge dumbing down the science for lowly MPs to understand?
No, I wouldn't necessarily call it dumbing down, but I think what we do is present it in a very accessible manner. So the essential facts are still there and there's no distortion of the reality of what's going on. But we tend to avoid jargon and acronyms, and everything's quite clearly explained. So it's very concise and they can get a good awareness without feeling patronised. Mm.
What is the biggest challenge right now with explaining science? Because a lot of it gets more and more specific nowadays.
I suppose our backgrounds are very science specific. So most of the fellows at Post are doing PhDs in specific science areas. So it's a challenge for us to try and make it accessible to people. But we were talking about this earlier and kind of science within labs and how to promote the professors of the lab broadcasting their research to the wider public.
We had a few more minutes from each of these interesting people, which you can find on the Poddelusion website. As well, you can find the link to the Roberts lecture in full at poddelusion.co.uk. The London Science Festival continues over the weekend, so if you find yourself free and fancy a lecture or two, follow the links on the Poddelusion website to find out what's on. This has been Liz Lusendorf for the Poddelusion.
Now, the world looked on this week as, at long last, a massive pain in the arse was finally finished off in full glare of the media spotlight in a morally questionable way. Most people listening are probably thinking of the extrajudicial killing of Colonel Gaddafi, but I imagine that if anyone is listening from the small market town I grew up in, or any other small market town for that matter, you may have been thinking of the eviction of the travellers at Dale Farm. You see, I'm sort of programmed to hate gypsies.
presumably thanks to genetic mutations in the incredibly limited gene pool where I grew up. But thankfully reason has transcended this and I'm now a member of the Right On PC Brigade, which is why the Dale Farm eviction is troubling, as Adam Jacobs explains in this next report.
This week, a planning dispute which had been rumbling on for many years finally reached the end of its legal process. A group of Irish travellers on the Dale Farm site near Basildon in Essex have built some dwellings on a former scrapyard site, which they own, without planning permission. Now that the legal battle over this has come to an end, with the courts confirming that the site had no planning permission, Basildon Council can lawfully remove the illegally constructed buildings. And as I record this on Thursday, they're doing so as part of a multi-million pound operation involving bailiffs and police. The buildings were constructed illegally, so of course it's perfectly right and proper that they're now being removed. It's really as simple as that. End of story. This has been Adam Jacobs reporting for the Daily Mail. Oh, sorry, wait, what's that you say, little voice in my earpiece? This is for the Pod Delusion, not the Daily Mail. And you tell me that Pod Delusion listeners are a sceptical bunch who may not believe me if I say it's really as simple as that? Ah, okay. Well, in that case, I guess perhaps I should go on and look at some of the reasons why it might not actually be quite as simple as that. Let's start with looking at the planning permission. The argument that it's really as simple as that would carry more weight if breaches of planning law were dealt with even-handedly, with all breaches facing the same robust enforcement action we've seen at Dale Farm, irrespective of whether those breaching the law were a vulnerable minority group or a rich and powerful corporation. It took me about 5 seconds of Googling to find a news story about a Tesco store that opened in Stockport in 2004, which was larger than the size of store that had been granted planning permission. The council then denied retrospective planning permission for the extra size. Can you guess what happened next? Do you think they sent the bailiffs in to tear down the store? Well, I won't spoil the ending for you. I'm sure you can find the ending yourself if you Google for it. And that, as I say, was with 5 seconds of Googling. I'm pretty sure that this wasn't the only time that companies like Tesco have breached planning laws. Now, the Dale Farm site is technically on Greenbelt land, and that seems to have been the main justification Basildon Council have given for refusing planning permission. However, it is the site of a former scrapyard, and indeed part of the site does have planning permission, so even if the illegal part were to be removed, a traveller community would still remain. There are some pretty shocking statistics out there when you look at how the gypsy and traveller community are treated by the planning system. One widely quoted statistic is that 90% of planning applications from the gypsy and traveller community are initially rejected, compared with only 20% overall. That's actually a little bit misleading, because many of those 90% that are initially rejected are subsequently granted on appeal. But still, 90% versus 20% is pretty dramatic, and it's hard to believe that there isn't some sort of discrimination at work here. Now, I know anecdotes are not data and all that, but I have seen anti-gypsy discrimination from a local council official at first hand. A couple of years ago, the bin in which the rubbish from my office gets put disappeared mysteriously from our car park. As this was more or less at exactly the same time that the bin men from Merton Council came to collect it, I thought perhaps the council had taken it away. When we contacted them to ask, they denied this and said, as I later discovered on the basis of pure speculation, that it had probably been stolen by gypsies. Think about that for a minute. How would it sound if Merton Council had said, "It was probably stolen by some black guys"? I don't think anyone would think that was acceptable, would they? I contacted the chief executive of Merton Council with my concerns about this, but he wasn't in the least bit interested. This kind of behaviour makes me find it easy to believe that anti-gypsy prejudice may be endemic in local councils. Whether gypsies and travellers constitute a race is controversial, although the question has been tested in the English courts in the context of race discrimination legislation, and the courts have decided that they do. But I'm not sure it's that important whether you call anti-gypsy discrimination racism or not. It's still discrimination against a minority group. There are, of course, important differences between discrimination against black people and discrimination against the gypsy and traveller community. While one is racism pure and simple, the other is connected to the lifestyle that gypsies and travellers lead. This lifestyle, involving caravans that may stay in one place for much of the time but sometimes move around the country, is something that most people find strange. I certainly find it strange. You probably do too. But there's an important question here about the extent to which society should be tolerant of alternative lifestyles. I don't think that finding a particular lifestyle strange is a good enough reason to deny it to people who choose to follow it. However, it's quite common to hear allegations of antisocial behaviour from traveller sites. Stories of rubbish left behind, petty theft, travellers having a shit in someone's front garden and so on. It's very hard to know how common these problems are. No doubt some are genuine, but they may be talked up as part of anti-traveller sentiment. But even if significant antisocial behaviour from travellers is a problem, is that a good reason for collective punishment? Unless we believe that all members of the travelling community are guilty of such behaviour, wouldn't the more rational response be to seek out those individuals responsible and punish them in the normal way? I really don't think this is a simple issue. We should be tolerant of alternative lifestyles. We don't need to be tolerant of lifestyles that are clearly antisocial. The argument that leaving great big piles of rubbish behind on traveller sites needs to be respected as part of a different culture doesn't convince me. The majority in a society has a right to expect minorities to conform to certain standards of behaviour, but does not have the right to expect them to behave like the majority in every way. Where you draw the line is, of course, a massive grey area. Anyway, it's pretty clear that a great many people don't want to have gypsy and traveller sites anywhere near them. You only have to look at the Dale Farm hashtag on Twitter to see that anti-traveller prejudice is rampant. Comments such as, "fuck off pikey scum," are frighteningly common. If those sentiments are widespread in real life as well, then perhaps it's not surprising that planning permission for traveller sites is frequently denied by the planning process, which, at least in theory, is controlled democratically through our elected representatives in local government. It's quite possible that a majority of residents in any local area don't want a gypsy site near them, so to refuse planning permission is democratic. That doesn't, however, make it right. It seems to me to be a classic example of what the 19th century political theorist Alexis de Tocqueville described as the tyranny of the majority. What I think it boils down to is that we're discriminating against a group of people because they follow a lifestyle that most people find strange. The eviction at Dale Farm has turned into a full-scale media circus, which I think is massively unhelpful and is probably only serving to make any divisions between the traveller and settled communities even more entrenched. It's attracted a number of so-called supporters whose motivations for protesting at the site are not clear to me. Some may genuinely want to help, but there's a definite feel of rent-a-mob about some of the things I've seen. And it's interesting to note that all the people arrested during the eviction were outside protesters, not Dale Farm residents. While I completely understand the Dale Farm residents' frustration with the way the planning process is stacked against them and completely support their right to peaceful protest and resistance of the eviction, some of the protests have been unacceptably violent, involving such things as throwing bricks at the police. Even if that's happening despite the protests of the Dale Farm residents, it's really not helping their case in the court of public opinion. Banners talking about ethnic cleansing are also unhelpful. While I think the eviction is horribly wrong on many levels, let's not forget that, despite the legalities, families are having their homes forcibly removed. It's not even remotely comparable to what happened in Bosnia in the 1990s, which is what most people would understand by ethnic cleansing. All in all, I find this whole episode terribly sad. A minority group is clearly facing intolerable discrimination, and it doesn't look like that discrimination is going away anytime soon. The eviction is widely reported to be costing £18 million, which hardly seems a good use of Basildon Council taxpayers' money. I'm pretty sure that there must have been other solutions to the problem that didn't involve hugely expensive forced evictions. But sadly, the politicians of Basildon Council have judged that being tough on the Dale Farm residents was a vote winner. This, to my mind, says some very unpleasant things about our society. This has been Adam Jacobs, really reporting for The Pod Delusion.
It's not really been a good week for Christianity. If it's not the Catholic Church masterminding a systematic kidnapping of 300,000 kids in Spain, some evangelical Christians have been getting a slap on the wrist in this country for claiming that HIV can be cured through prayer. To horrify us some more, here's Naomi Phillips.
Hi, I'm Naomi Phillips. I'm the Head of Public Affairs at the British Humanist Association. And I would just wanted to talk for a few minutes about evangelical churches, HIV and miracle cures. Yesterday, the BBC reported on its own investigation into a number of evangelical churches in London, which are promising all sorts of things on their websites and in leaflets and in person, from having miracle cures, so such as curing cancer through prayer, right up to ridding people of their HIV infection through religious practice. On the one hand, you might say, well, they can believe what they want. If people want to do lots of praying and think that will make them feel better and heal them of all sorts of ailments, why not? Well, the BBC investigation found that at least three people had died because they had been so convinced by their Christian pastors and their churches and probably the wider congregation that prayer would heal them, would cure them, in fact, of HIV, AIDS, and that they stopped taking their medication. In fact, there is evidence from this investigation to show that they were, in fact, advised by their religious leaders to stop taking antiretroviral drugs, which is keeping the infection at bay and keeping them alive, and to pray instead, because if they kept taking the medication, then the prayers might not work so well. I was quoted in The Independent today saying, in a free society, people have the absolute right to believe what they want. However, when those in positions of influence, particularly over very vulnerable people, are promoting false cures through religious practice and even encouraging people to turn away from proper medicine, then more needs to be done. So I think it's right that people can interfere in this. I'd like to see government doing something about it, because we're not just talking about people making independent choices free from coercion, which is something that we who value the principles of living in a liberal and free and democratic society would hold absolutely, that people can believe what they want and should be able to make choices free from coercion. But I simply don't believe that people in the most vulnerable state, people who are have life-threatening illnesses, incurable conditions, for example, and are being told of miracle cures, that they absolutely believe in this and are being convinced to stop taking medication. I think those people are vulnerable. I think that there is a much wider question of the public health involved. It's not just about individuals, it's about the wider public health. And I think that that means that government and others should intervene. But although it's a slightly different topic, there is precedent for some sort of intervention. Way back in 2008, we saw the repeal of what was called the Fraudulent Mediums Act 1951. And it was replaced with much stricter regulations, basically trading standards regulations. And the point of that was that there were so many dishonest and fraudulent mediums and psychics and all kind of practitioners like that making a huge amount of money, basically by ripping off vulnerable people who really wanted to believe that they could contact the dead, that they could see into the future, that they could read right into their souls. Basically, they are exploiting them. The psychic industry itself is huge and lucrative and exploitative, and some people are vulnerable, some people are gullible. But either way, the government saw fit a couple of years ago to change the rules so that people had more protection from people making claims for which there was no scientific evidence. So you may, if you ever go to a medium or a psychic now, you may find that they have to give you a little disclaimer card saying that they cannot prove what they're going to tell you, that it isn't absolutely true. And although that might seem a bit flippant in the context of what I was mentioning earlier, in terms of really stopping people being killed or dying through believing the false claims of some of these churches, I think more needs to be done. We can't just say it's their religion, they can do what they want. They can't, actually. And I think that if people are really promoting things which are simply not true, things that are proving to be deadly, then we should do something about it.
A new project has launched recently to try and educate the media on transgendered issues, and about time too. Despite there being an estimated 300,000 trans people in the UK, when was the last time you saw a transgender-related issue being discussed on the telly? In fact, one horrifying statistic that I've just made up, but sounds like it's probably true, is that the former Sun editor and all-round bad person Kelvin McKenzie single-handedly gets more airtime than every other transgender person put together. And if that doesn't send a shiver down your spine, I don't know what made-up statistics will. So to find out more about the new campaign, Liz Luckendorf has been speaking to Natalie McDermott from On Road Media. If Ricky Gervais is listening, now might be a good time for him to switch off, as we don't really want him reclaiming any more words.
A few weeks ago at Westminster Skeptics in the Pub, Juliet Jacks gave a talk on thinking critically about transgender issues. In the discussion that followed the talk, we found out about seed funding given to On Road Media and Transmedia Watch to help highlight transgender issues. The funding is for a project called Transmedia Action, which will hopefully help educate the media on trans issues, but also come up with innovative projects that can be further funded. I sat down with Natalie McDermott from On Road Media to talk about what they're planning to do with the funding, but also the problems with how the media portrays trans people and trans issues.
So my role, I work for On Road Media, which is a social enterprise, and we work with people on the margins or people who are misrepresented in the media, and we try and help turn that around. So my role with Transmedia Action is to run this project, which is being funded by Channel 4 and the BBC, to try and find different ways that we can penetrate the consciousness of your average journalist to excite them and engage them with issues around transgender and the community so that they end up doing their job better, you know, with our guidance. So I'm very much an intermediary, and I'm the project manager of the project.
So what is the plan for the funding for Transmedia Action?
So it's really rare and lovely when you get a pot of cash like this, because we've been given £21,000, so it's seed funding, but it's quite difficult to get seed funding where you can kind of try things out. Often you have to go with a very clear idea with what you want to do with that money. So we have been given this fantastic few months to play around with various different things. So what we're going to do is two main things. One is to run a series of pilot workshops with journalists where we're helping them to, you know, like I said, helping them to become excited about trans as an issue and helping them to come up with really innovative ways of dealing with it. The other thing we're doing is we're running a social innovation camp, which basically brings together developers, so techie, geeky, lovely types like that, people from the trans community, and innovators, social entrepreneur types. Brings them together to come up with a whole host of innovative solutions that we haven't thought about. Again, finding those entry points for journalists is key, because each journalist has a cycle. They have an entry point to a story. They think, what surprised me about that issue? They then think, what else do I need to learn? And they then hopefully take some sort of action. Now, there aren't enough good entry points for journalists into transgender issues. So that's really the area that we're working around, is to create more of those. Mm-hmm. And we're hoping that these activities will throw up a whole host of interesting ideas.
So aside from not really knowing entry points into the issues, are there any common pitfalls that the media usually falls into when dealing with trans issues?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, from what I've learned from the trans community and from what I've seen, there's very little understanding about transgender issues all across the media. I mean, level of understanding is really low, even in the liberal press, even in the areas where you think it would be better. It's very, very low. It hasn't really been, there aren't very many portrayals of transgender people in, you know, in movies and in programs on television. So people have very few sort of reference points. So people make the mistake all the time of misgendering people. So when calling a transgender woman he, saying things like, she was born a man, you know, when no one was actually born a man. Saying things that, you know, possibly the average person wouldn't think was offensive, but is deeply offensive to a transgender person who knows themselves to be to be that person themselves. So there are all sorts of ways that the media chooses to depict it and to often sensationalise the story. what they do, which is so offensive and problematic, is that they bring the fact that someone is transgender into a story when it has no bearing on that story whatsoever. And that's the real issue on the news side. And actually, as David Alan Green from New Statesman would say, this is really an issue of privacy. Your status, your gender, has absolutely nothing to do with whether you've been involved in something good or bad. And it seems to be sort of dragged up, and it's the headline of the story, regardless of what the story is about. And then they will feel that they have license to uncover all of that person's personal and private history when it has no bearing on the story whatsoever.
I guess since there's so many people who blog and are, you know, we do a podcast, aside from journalists getting workshops, where can people go who like to blog and who want to know more about this issue go to find out how to treat, you know, trans issues?
Mm-hmm. Well, Transmedia Watch is the organisation that I first came across. And I say organisation, it's a group of these brilliant women who, you know, aren't paid to do this. And they basically monitor the media. They watch and see what the media is doing. And whenever there's a story about trans people, good or bad, they will sort of flag it up. And they have a Facebook group, and which has great discussions on it. They have really good resources on their website, and they have really good resources for journalists, a really clear how to and what's offensive and what isn't. And also for, you know, the average Joe to have a look, to learn a bit more about this, because it is a really fascinating area. So I would go there, definitely.
To use a horrible industry phrase, for those seeking to kind of emulate best practice, are there any examples of media outlets that are getting this right, essentially?
The Guardian tends to get it better than everyone else, and, you know, which is probably unsurprising. But every now and then, different papers, you know, get it right. Daily Mail had a well-written article about a young trans girl who sort of came back to school in the autumn term as a girl, and there was, you know, it was kind of well written. But someone at Transmedia Watch pointed out that it was because the Sun had done the same story and it was very negative, so they thought that they were just taking the other side to it. So it does happen in pockets. It does happen, and, you know, generally it seems okay. Daily Mail aside, generally it seems that, you know, most papers are getting it wrong out of sheer ignorance. They just simply do not know what phrases are offensive and why.
If you'd like to find out more about what was discussed in this report, follow the links on the Pod Delusion website. There you can also find the full discussion from Juliet Jack's talk from Westminster Skeptics. This has been Liz Lustendorf for the Pod Delusion.
Now in this next report, Salim Fadli looks at the new English translation of the book Solaris. And it's only 50 years late. It's enough to make Duke Nukem Forever feel rushed. Here's Salim Fadli with more.
Solaris by Stanislaw Lem is arguably one of the most admired works of science fiction in any language. Originally written in Polish in 1961, it's been made into two feature films, and the book has been translated into many other European languages, with the notable exception of English. It's taken more than 50 years since the text was originally published, but now we English speakers have an accurate translation. I spoke with the book's translator, Bill Johnson, who is a professor of comparative literature at Indiana University. I began by asking Bill why it took so long to get a decent translation of this most important novel.
The short answer is that the book was translated in some form and published back in 1970, and the details of the contract for that publication meant that it wasn't possible to publish a different translation. And in this particular case, the translation into English was made from the French translation, so it was a double translation, and kind of a lot of things got squidged up and changed. The translators were not working with the original text, because I know Lem was unhappy with the English translation, but the contract made it impossible for him to do anything about that. And I think the estate finally realized that with the new technologies, there was a chance to put something out that was maybe not in book form, but was a much closer translation directly from the Polish. And
Stanisław Lem is a literary hero in Poland, so it must be a pretty daunting task to attempt a translation of his most famous novel. Were you willing to face the consequences from Lem's fans if they didn't like your translation?
Well, it's always a worry, and not just with Lem, but with working with any major text. And I think you just have to, you know, man up and kind of face that. my feeling was that I know Polish well, and I think I produced pretty good English text, and I knew that I would produce something which was much closer to the Polish original than what had been done before. So I guess my level of anxiety was not excessive in this particular case. And with the science fiction aspect, I did show it to, I showed the text to a couple of people who read science fiction much more widely. They helped me with a little bit of the terminology. Yeah, otherwise, I just felt I'll put it out there and there will be people who like it and people who don't, as usual.
Can you talk about some of the themes in this novel? Lem sets us up for what initially seems like the old cliché of an alien encounter, but then he completely overturns our expectations by revealing the most utterly alien other world ever conceived in literature.
Yeah, I mean, one could read the book as kind of the ultimate opposite of E.T., you know, where in E.T. you've got this adorable little creature that desperately wants to communicate with humans. In Solaris, the alien being, we don't even know if it is a being, it's just this sort of oozy black ocean that washes around the planet in this very sluggish way. And it's not even clear whether it in fact is in any real sense sentient or a living being or anything like that. One can unpeel levels in the book, obviously, but I think it does revolve around the basic idea that we have this urge to communicate within us, and one can see this in science fiction terms in terms of communicating with non-human beings, but I think it's also very much to do with the possibility of communication even between people. And Lem just constantly undercuts our expectations of the desire for any response, or indeed our ability to read that response. I mean, I think that's because the ocean does do things, but ultimately, as one of the characters in the book points out, what it does is reflect ourselves back to us. Yeah, I mean, it does seem to me to be a very pessimistic account of the limits of what it can mean to communicate, what it can mean to read a response. And at some point, one of the characters says that we pretend that we're looking for alien civilizations, but maybe we're just looking for ourselves.
Much of the plot of the book involves repeated but utterly failed attempts to communicate. By the end of the book, the astronauts who've been trying to communicate with the Solaris Ocean are completely defeated, and they become convinced that communication is futile. Right. Do you think this scenario reflected Lem's personal beliefs about the difficulty or impossibility of human communication?
It is quite a pessimistic book in many ways. Ultimately, with this very unresponsive ocean, the reader's attention is drawn to the relationships between the main character, Calvin, between him and Snout, the only other human being that we kind of see it on a regular basis in the book. And, of course, with Hare, with body of a woman who reality is kind of unclear. And the inability to communicate with the outside ocean is kind of reflected in the character's inability to come to terms with their own limitations, with truly conveying what it is that they want to convey. It is a book where, at the end, one is left with a fairly bleak picture of the actual possibilities of conveying, communicating things that actually mean something to us.
This is the first translation into English that has been approved by the Lem Estate, and it's certainly a very different work of fiction to the 2002 Soderbergh movie adaptation. I understand that Lem himself was upset that his novel about an incomprehensible alien world had been transformed by Hollywood into Love in Outer Space. Lem's original really isn't like that at all, is it?
It really isn't, no. I mean, in a sense, he sets you up because you're on the spaceship. This beautiful woman appears who is clearly devoted to Calvin, the main character. The assumptions that we make when we start reading that storyline are very quickly undercut. I think the transition from literature to film is always and everywhere very problematic. And, you know, in a sense, we should say that Soderbergh should be allowed to just take from the book what he wants. But I think if I were Lem, I would be pissed off too.
I enjoyed Soderbergh's film as being certainly a cut above typical Hollywood products.
Right,
but
exactly,
it really bore no resemblance at all to the book.
I think if we just take it as a film sort of on its own terms, that's fine, and maybe one that took Solaris as its inspiration in whatever way, but I don't think philosophical or ideological terms it could be described in any way as faithful.
In your own work as a professional translator and a teacher of translation, Do you find any irony in having just helped to translate a book whose main thesis is utter pessimism about mankind's ability to meaningfully relate to just about anybody?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I mean, the ultimate irony, of course, is that translators don't really convey anything at all anyway. There isn't a single word of the original Polish in the translation, and so one could say that, in a sense, everything has, in fact, been lost. When one looks closely at the process of translation, you find that apparent linguistic equivalents crumble between the fingers. Simple concepts like home, family, the body, none of these translate directly. If you look at the associations of a word like body, the Polish word ciało has the extra meaning of flesh, you know, which is different. For each of the languages, the semantic network of additional meanings and even idioms and so on is really radically different. And so translation is a con artist's game in a way, that you think you're getting the real thing. And the original experience of reading the book is really quite different. Once one really digs beneath those apparently faithful equivalences, they start to disintegrate. And so I think Lem himself would probably appreciate that irony rather than anything else.
If you want to hear Bill's translation of Solaris, it's available right now via audible.com. You can get a copy of it for free and help support the show by using our affiliate link in the show notes. This is Salim Fadli for The Pod Delusion.
Now, you may remember a few months ago when the world was gripped by fear of the end of the world. Harold Camping, who is president of the Christian radio station Family Radio, had predicted, based on the Bible, that the world was due to end on May the 21st. As you might have noticed, he wasn't entirely correct, as, after all, we're still here today. Though since we have somehow managed to interview a Nobel Prize winner and a cabinet minister in the same programme, there is some circumstantial evidence that hell has indeed frozen over. Anyway, Camping has done the sums and has predicted a new date for the end of the world. Today. I'm not certain he's entirely right, but the announcement that Westlife are to split up is certainly the end of my world. To find out more, assuming the world doesn't end at the end of this sentence, here's Tom Hodden.
Good news, everybody. We have a new date for the end of the world from Harold Camping and the Family Radio people. Oh wait, you remember them, don't you? They were the guys who said definitely, completely and utterly, no questions asked, the world was going to end on May the 21st. As you will know, if you were listening to the excellent coverage given by this very podcast, it didn't. Brilliant. So, what are Family Radio saying now? Well, for a start, they're saying that what happened on May the 21st was exactly what God planned all along. Handily, they found some new ways to interpret some of the quotes from the Bible, which have been retrofitted and recalibrated to fit a new version where the world didn't end on May the 21st. Instead, it entered a five-month judgment period, so the world is now going to end on the 21st of October 2011. Put that in your diary. Everybody who is not a true believer is being judged. True believers, of course, are not requiring judgment, because being a true believer and doing anything wrong are apparently an impossible combination. This is because the correct way to interpret some of the quotes in the Bible had been withheld until May the 21st. God, it seems, wanted them withheld as a test for us all. Only after May the 21st could we be told the reading really meant, because if it had not been withheld, the world would never have been shaken with fear as it was. If there was any evidence needed that this story is unfolding in a strange alternative universe, it's the fact they think the world was shaken with fear. Perhaps they were unaware of the utter apathy with which the world shrugged its shoulders. But I digress. Their new contention is that the word earth or ground in the Bible can actually mean people. So an earthquake could also mean that people of the earth quaking, not an earthquake. How jolly clever and self-correcting. Exactly what evidence there is of the people quaking is a little beyond me, but the Family Radio page makes it quite clear we have all quaked with fear like we never quaked before. A word to be redefined, with a benefit of hindsight, is rapture. All that stuff about rapture being people vanishing up to heaven, be safe by God's side, all a mistake. It means your soul is safe. It is the completion of God's salvation program. Their words, not mine. From what I can figure, if your soul was raptured, it means that your soul has been protected and has a place waiting for it in heaven when the time comes. However, after May the 21st, none of us can complete this salvation program now, so we have no chance of being raptured. Have you spotted the slight hole beneath the waterline? If the Salvation Program ended and there was no further way of being raptured up to heaven once the time comes, what exactly is the point of the 5-month judgmental period? The 5-month judgmental period by an omnipotent, all-seeing, all-knowing being. I am an atheist. By the definition being used, I cannot be raptured. Does the Almighty need 5 more months to make definitely sure I'm an atheist? Apparently, I cannot be raptured, but I'm in God's hands, and at the last moments when the world ends, I can still beseech him for mercy, which is nice. So what exactly will happen on October the 21st? Well, given the form, there seems to be 2 distinct options. Either the world will end, and my godless soul will be tormented, while the powers beyond my ken try to decide if I am a decent and nice chap despite my not believing in them, or Howard Camping and the good people over at familyradio.com will continue to retrofit their prophecies to meet the new facts, like the world not ending. I'll give you one guess which I would consider the most likely outcome based on the evidence. Links to the full explanation will no doubt be on the Pod Delusion homepage by the time you listen to this, so you can decide for yourself now exactly how unfair I've been. This has been Tom Hodden waiting for the end of the world for the Pod Delusion.
And that's it for this week's show. Before we go, a plug for the Pod Delusion Extra feed, where this week we've spoilt you guys rotten with so much good stuff to listen to. If you head over to poddelusion.co.uk right now, you can listen to the full Roberts Lecture with David Willetts. You can also listen to the 2nd episode of the Cine Sci 6 podcast discussing the science and the impact of the 1956 film Forbidden Planet. You can also hear Edward Presswood giving his London Skeptics in the Pub talk why you can't count on a rational NHS, and indeed listen to the British Humanist Association talk by James Onan on the rise of scepticism in Uganda. All are, of course, exclusive to poddelusion.co.uk. Also on our website, you can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and find links related to all of the things we've covered on this week's show. Now some awkward begging. If you like the Pod Delusion and want to support what we do, why not subscribe with £5 or £10 a month or make a one-off donation on our website? You can find out how to do so at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Cash Farouk, Adam Jacobs, Naomi Phillips, Nick Borer, Salim Fadley, Tom Hodden, Liz Luckendorf, and me, James O'Malley, with much additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The sketch at the end is by David Lovesey, Brian Too, and Steve Clark. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
You're back. We've been worried.
I'm sorry, Mr. Blocker.
So who kidnapped you? Was it those extremist delinquents of the anti-fascist action?
No, Christoph. I've been away to think. Being the goat mascot of the Swiss People's Party is a serious responsibility and I needed to clear my head.
So you weren't kidnapped?
No. My fellow goat Mima and I have been on a retreat, evaluating our policies and making sure of our position as mascot of a major far-right party.
And what have you decided?
Mr. Blocker, Christoph. I am afraid I cannot in all conscience represent the SVP. I have become a liberal.
What? You have become a turncoat?
No, Christoph. But as a moralistic goat, I cannot subscribe to your mission to create a nanny state. I am not kidding, and I'll work like billy-o to see your aims thwarted. And my fellow goat feels the same.
So we've wasted the last 2 weeks finding Mimo. You are both of the same mind?
We are. I have considered immigration and our foreign policies, and I can truly say that I have become a goat of many colours. That is why I have sprayed myself black, to show solidarity with the black sheep your poster campaign has sought to kick out.
Well, Zotto, The SVP cannot associate itself with you any longer. If your left-wing attitudes are to taint all we are working towards, I bid you farewell.
Goodbye, Mr. Blocker. We will meet again whenever debate is needed.
Farewell, Zottel. It seems that you are well set to become some lolloping liberal technicolor dream goat.
Really? That sounds interesting. There might be a musical in that.